Hey everyone, welcome to Stutter Talk. You're about to hear a wonderful conversation with Dorvin H. Breitenfeld, Professor Emeritus from Eastern Washington University and a living legend in the area of stuttering. Dorv developed the successful stuttering management program, the SSMP, and has facilitated over 40 intensive stuttering workshops. Dorv was awarded the Clinician of Distinction Award by the International Fluency Association, and the National Stuttering Association dedicated their 1995 convention to him. Dr. Breitenfeld is one of only a few stutterers to serve in the U.S. Army on a commissioned status and was discharged as a first lieutenant. Now on to the show. Everyone, welcome to Stutter Talk, continuing our tradition of opening with a good voluntary stutter. I am Peter Reitzis. This is episode 269 for March 27th, 2011. Stutter Talk, changing how you think about stuttering one podcast at a time. It is my absolute honor and privilege to welcome to the show Dorvin H. Breitenfeld. How are you doing today, Dr. Breitenfeld?
I'm fine. And by the way, do call me Dorv. I prefer that. It's really my pleasure to be on the Stutter Talk.
Well, I have to be honest with you and the listeners. I'm a little nervous today because you might not know this, but I consider you to be a tremendous mentor, a tremendous therapist, and a tremendous advocate for people who stutter. As we were talking before we went on air, I met you at the University of Utah when I was a graduate student doing a practicum at the Successful Stuttering Management Program, a program that you created, and I want to ask you all about the SSMP and your life with stuttering. If it's all right with you, I'd like to go back to your early childhood. I know that you grew up in the 1930s during the Great Depression. You went to school in a one-room schoolhouse. What was it like to be a child who stutters during that time in that environment?
I think my stuttering grew like and developed like most children, and I recall vividly being chased home by the bigger kid called the Stutter Cat all the way home. And of course, in my particular class, there were only six kids. We started as first graders, and we ended up as eighth graders. But my stuttering continued to become more and more severe, and I continued to hide it more and more. Even my older brother, whom I roomed with, didn't really know I stuttered because I simply was this master at hiding my stuttering and saying very little by the time I had finished eighth grade, unable to continue with school, and so I dropped out at the ninth grade.
Did you drop out because of your stuttering?
Oh, yes. Yes, no way that I felt, or could I at that time, manage high school environment, talking in class, on and on. And so I simply went to high school and dropped out because of my stuttering. I didn't give that as a reason, though.
Okay.
I lied a lot. And which I thought, my folks needed me home on the farm, which of course is not true at all, but that was my excuse. I wouldn't tell anyone that I was a stutterer.
Yeah, I'm sorry to keep jumping in here, but on Stutter Talk, on Stutter Talk recently, I've been using the term a lot, passing as fluent, because I passed as fluent for much of my life. Did you, at this age, were you passing as a fluent, non-stuttering speaker?
I made every effort to do so. Okay. I probably fooled less people than I thought I did, but I simply didn't do anything. You know, I just didn't use a telephone at all until I had my first therapy at age 17, and so no one knew that I couldn't talk on a phone. I didn't even try it. I suppose I made every effort to pass myself off as a fluent person, and which required massive avoidance and all the tricks that a stutterer can use to keep from stuttering, and sometimes saying nothing more than just little offhand-wise comments, something like that, or found I could get started by interrupting others. A number of our stutterers do that. And
I did that a lot in high school.
I knew that wasn't the appropriate thing to do. That's the only time I could get started. And so, yes, as you said, I very much passed myself off, at least I thought I did, as a fluent person, non-stutterer, who was the overachiever in school and had never got into any major trouble. I stayed out of it, so I didn't have to account for it. That, in turn, made people feel, oh, he's just a quiet person and a good little student, and but isn't difficult to work with. Teachers had no difficulties with me because I was afraid of getting into difficulties. How could I get out of it when I couldn't talk?
Now, in the second half of the show, I want to ask you a lot about speech tools, but I just want to point out to the listeners that I can really hear you working through some stutters. I think you just said the word just, and you basically did a just. Was that some type of a pullout?
Yes, just like the word yes. Now, if I didn't work my way through it, I would have hung you up for a minute or more. And so, yes, I do very much have to continue to use light contacts, prolongation, pullouts, or in-block correction. And, of course, for most stutterers, my stuttering is very situational. Sometimes I have much more difficulty managing it than other times. But yes, I do find it very necessary to do something with managing my stuttering. I like the word, might use the word managing. I think that's maybe the best we can do for our stutterers too, is to manage it. In other words, communicate successfully as a stutterer. And they tell me that isn't much better than what, that non-stutterers don't do much better than that, except they don't stutter.
Yeah, I like that word manage too. And again, I just wanted the listeners to listen for all of those stutters that you manage and that you work through, just to point it out to them, because you really practice what you preach, and I think it's great. So when you were 17, you went back to high school and you graduated at 21. What type of help did you get with your stuttering that you were able to go back to high school?
I attended, of course, my finally one night, if I can go back just a bit.
Sure.
Age 17, we were, as farmers do, you go to farm to the town on Saturday night. That was an evening. I'd read some of the Benjamin Vogue materials. Could be cured and so forth, getting rid of all in secrecy. And that was a night of bringing the stuttering out to my parents and simply telling them that, you know, my life can't go on. And suicide is my only way out. I can't ask a girl for a date. Nothing I can really do. I can't talk on the telephone. And so then we went to a family doctor and a clinic in Moorhead, Fargo, Minnesota, and then referred me to University of Minnesota, Dr. Braden Bringelson, one of the old people in the field of speech pathology, and then I attended an intensive 6-week therapy program for stutterers at the University of Minnesota. I came home, basically a stutter modification program, lots of fear reduction and so forth. And it happened to me, unfortunately, that after about 3 weeks, I developed what many of us call lucky fluency. I went through the last 3 weeks with very little stuttering to work with, even though I did everything, the practice material and speaking in many situations. I just didn't have much practice, and so quit actual stuttering. And then I started high school and talked to all my classes and teachers about my stuttering and did my advertising diligently. But as there was really no set after therapy or continuing therapy on once a week basis over the phone or something like that. And so after about 3 months, my stuttering started to return. And by the time I finished my freshman year, age 18, my outward stuttering, which consisted of many very long silent blocks, nothing just came out.
Mm.
Most of it had returned, but my attitude stayed quite well. So then I returned to the same intensive therapy program the following summer. And fortunately, I think, looking back at it now, that I had essentially the same amount of stuttering to work on when I started the intensive program as when I ended it. And that was advantageous because I then had lots of experiences and talking with people about my stuttering and practicing management of my stuttering in many, many situations. Even though I was disappointed that I wasn't, quote, fluent again, although that was never the goal, certainly was helpful that I had stuttering to work on, and then I realized that, oh, I'm really going to be a stutter for life, and I better somehow learn to lead a successful life as a stutterer. And
sure.
That was an important revelation to me.
I just want to remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk, speaking with Dr. Dorvin Breitenfeld, Professor Emeritus at Eastern Washington University. Now I understand why. When I was in Utah at the SSMP, you really warned over and over again about lucky fluency or the curse of lucky fluency. You warned over and over again that this was the beginning of therapy and that when you go home, you need to work with other stutterers. You need to find a therapist to continue the work that you started. It sounds like you learned how important these things were through your own therapy experiences.
Yes, I think that's true. I have based my therapeutic approach quite extensively on my own therapy experiences, the problems I had maintaining, so forth. And ours. I have found that the greatest unsolved problem we have in this managing stuttering is maintenance of improvements following therapy.
Mm.
It isn't difficult to get a stutterer to manage his stuttering or to become fluent, for that matter. And I have never been a strong advocate of a fluency approach. To give you a small example, a word I can always stutter on and I'll let it go for a while is the word unique. That was all real stuff. And so I can get myself fluent on that by going unique. I can say it 1,000 times right now, I'm fluent. And learning theory would say, okay, if you've said it that many times fluently, then you should be able to say it the rest of your life. Other things we learn, them well, and they're there. Well, let's try it now. Unique. I stuttering is all back. Yeah. Unique. Now it's gone.
Mm.
And so that's certainly one of the reasons I have not been an advocate of strict fluency approach, even though, unfortunately, many of our stutterers do have less stuttering when they leave therapy. And I think it's unfortunate. But when you work on it so intensively, if you could do that all of your life, of course you would have much fluency too, but life gets in the way.
I just want to let the listeners know that the second half of the show will be devoted to the Successful Stuttering Management Program and your wonderful work there. So I want the list. I promise the listeners we're going to spend a lot of time on that, because I know that a lot of people are excited to hear you talk about that. Three days after you graduated from high school, you went to the university. You enrolled at the University of Minnesota, and you joined the Army Reserve Officers Training Corps. What was it like to be an officer in training who stuttered?
It was a challenge. This was the height of the Korean War at that time, and I already had joined the Navy, and they were waiting until I finished high school, and I had my Army physical, being conscripted at that time, but I was able to start college 3 days afterwards, University of Minnesota, and joined the Army ROTC, and found something occurring quite interestingly. As I finished a sophomore year of the Reserve Officers Training Corps program, you then aren't going to be accepted into Advanced Corps, and I was not going to be accepted into because of my stuttering. All the regulations of that time said stutterers could serve on a listed status, not a commissioned status. And so by this time in my life, I was dogged and stubborn enough that nothing was going to interfere with what I wanted to do. And I recall having to give a 15-minute presentation in front of several captains and a major, and having to drill some cadets out of the drill field to prove to the cadre that I could function as a stutterer and on a commission basis. Then I did, upon my graduating as a senior, received my commission at the same time, and the Korean War had ended at that time, and so I finished a master's degree and then went on active duty after that, and found that once more, in all situations, as a young officer, most of your teaching, that I once more have to advertise, and I have to do this. It looks like the rest of my life. But I found out, my friends say, well, if that's all you have to do, Dor, then just do it. We don't care.
So, that's great.
Yes, that was so true. And after I came out of active duty in the reserve several years, once more, it was simply necessary to pose as a stutterer, never as a non-stutterer. If I was going to manage my stuttering with some degree of success, I did like the Army. I like to spit and polish up it and so forth.
That's one of the things that really drew me to the SSMP, was feeling that total freedom to just go up to people and say, hey, my name is Peter and I'm a stutterer. And this concept of advertisement, which I believe you've said is the most important aspect of therapy, where did you come up with the idea? Did somebody encourage you to do it? Or did you figure out on your own that telling people you stutter would be very helpful?
I suppose a combination. Many of us come up in our professional lives with brand new things. We take some things from many others and put it together. But simply, I think I found out so that if I didn't pose as a stutterer and admit my stuttering, tell a stuttering joke, make some comment about it, and very soon, almost immediately in any new situation, that I simply wasn't going to handle it well. Soon these old avoidances returned. I could get by for quite a while being fluent, disgustingly fluent.
Sure.
But eventually my house of cards would cave in. And so soon found that that's going to be something I'll have to do for a lifetime. And yes, just 2 days ago, I saw my physical therapist for a little tendonitis in an arm, and of course had to, we got into a long discussion about physical therapy and, I mean, about stuttering, and talked her into seeing the King's speech that evening.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, I do have to advertise, and I think I soon found it out myself with the encouragement of others that this would be helpful, and I think is by far the most important technique a stutterer can use.
Let's just take a moment. Well, actually, there's so many things I want to talk to you about. Let's just take a quick moment. What did you think of the King's speech? Did you like the movie?
Yes, very much so. I think probably the King's speech has done more for the stuttering community than any other single thing in my lifetime. It's now okay. Well, first of all, the treatment of stuttering in a compassionate way has, for once, has been extremely important. And now we're finding stutterers coming, if I can use a crude term, coming out of the woodwork.
Mm-hmm.
And feeling free again to talk about stuttering. And the non-stuttering community, likewise, is not just using stuttering for jokes or accusing the stutterer of not being honest, or that's why he stutters, or on and on. I think it was well done. Certain other therapeutic techniques, not the ones we'd advocate, where you roll on the floor and things like that.
Right.
Use profanity, although certainly I've had stutterers who use profanity as part of their avoidance techniques.
Sure.
But so the therapeutic techniques, I think, are not probably appropriate at this time. But that's really beside the point. What's important is that it has brought stuttering out into the open, and the film receiving Oscar awards as well. In other words, gee, you can receive an Oscar for stuttering. That's kind of surprising to stutterers.
Yeah. Well, we had David Seidler on Stutter Talk a few months ago, the scriptwriter of the King's speech, and it was just, I mean, we're all so proud of him. I mean, you know, it's so great that he's up there thanking the stuttering world and accepting an Oscar on behalf of stutterers worldwide. I think that's just wonderful. I want to ask you one more thing, or share with you something. My time at the SSMP was so special, and I had at that time in my life, I knew a bunch of people who had gone through the programs. And one of the things I figured out for me was that I liked to advertise by actually using voluntary stuttering. So while I did hundreds and hundreds of surveys where I talked openly to people about stuttering, I found that by just going into a restaurant and ordering my food with some pretty hard stutters with eye contact, for me, that was sort of my way of advertising. I liked, because I was covert for so long, I really liked just stuttering on purpose or stuttering openly. So, I mean, I'm wondering, like, for you, at what point did the voluntary stuttering come in?
Yes, I think doing some intentional stuttering has numerous advantages, particularly when you have these fluency periods. We all are fluency junkies, and this is the time to use some voluntary stuttering. And it is a way of advertising. It's important, though, I think, when if we say that we advertise outwardly, I'm a stutterer, but they will also show some stuttering. Some stutterers then will be very fluent, and so the listener says, well, you're kidding me, aren't you? You see you're stuttering, I'm not hearing any. Well, give the listener what they're expecting. It's all the more important at that time to, if you don't have any real good stuttering, which isn't uncommon, to use some negative practice. One of the techniques I have found beneficial, since if you ask the typical layman, what's stuttering, they'll say, well, it's something like this. And we know we adult stutterers seldom stutter that way anymore. And so if that's what the lay folks think stuttering is, okay, let's feed them that. And so you use a bouncing technique to advertise your stuttering. If I would use my long silent blocks like this, they wouldn't know
right.
I was stuttering at all. And a bounce kind of technique, or some of your actual stuttering, I find I can fix some of my prolongations. I can easily turn real for me. Has just all kinds of advantages and to me. And it's a bit selfish, but that's sure. The way it is. I think maybe we stutterers, maybe two things. We have to be selfish, doing what's necessary for ourselves, and also keep the situation in our control. We stutterers, at least most of us, function much better if we have control of the situation. This doesn't mean you have to be a dominating kind of person at all, but you need to keep in control. And that, in turn, allows you, I think, to control your stuttering instead of the other way around, stuttering controlling us. And we know what hell that is when stuttering is controlling us.
Oh, yes. Well, this is Stutter Talk, 206-666-5340, stuttertalk@stuttertalk.com. I'm your host, Peter Reitzis, here with very special guest, I dare say a living legend, Dorvin H. Breitenfeld. I want to ask you about your speech pathology career before we go to break. Who were your mentors? Let's start with this. When you were going into the field of speech pathology, did the field receive you well as a person who stutters, or did people say to you, oh, you're a stutterer, you can't become a speech pathologist?
Well, that was very vivid in my undergraduate program. Bring Bringelson, who was chairman of the program, undergraduate program, candidly told me he did not feel a stutterer should be in the profession, and that they just could not manage the profession and should choose something else. And as I recall, he fought me throughout my undergraduate program. This old stubbornness in me saying I'm going to do what I want to do. And so, but years later, a convention, 10, 15 years later, he knew him. Sometimes he drank a little too much and put his arm around me and hugged me and said, gee, with the profanity, who the heck was he to discourage stutterers from entering the field? And that we now had many stutterers functioning successfully in the field. And so, yes, that was a challenge in my undergraduate program. Professionally, I think it hasn't, maybe in some ways it's even been advantageous, that I also have a problem that has been worked on and needs continuing work. And I think certainly with stutterers, it probably has an advantage. I will never know for sure, not never being a non-stutterer, but I think overall, since most of my time professionally was spent at universities, and it had probably an advantage to me if I turned it to an advantage. And I think we stutterers can turn our stuttering into an advantage, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just like if you're 6 feet tall at this time, you can push a sphere through a hoop, and
right.
You can win basketball games. And so you're taking advantage of an attribute you have, even though 7-footers don't fit in any beds and have trouble riding an airplane. And so we can turn our stuttering to our advantage as well. I remember, of course, I taught 3 years at Idaho State University, and then back and did my PhD program, and came here to Eastern Washington University in 1962. And part of the interviewing process, the last person you see is the president of the university, part of the interview. And I was being brought in to initiate a program. And, of course, obviously, well, I could use his name now, Dr. Patterson, the president, who has a building named after him, and, of course, is no longer alive, hadn't really looked through my credentials ahead of time, but started to look through them then while he cleaned his pipe. It was okay to smoke then.
Sure.
And said, oh, you are a stutterer. And I said, yes. He said, gee, I don't think stutterers can be professors. And he said, well, let me read some of your letters of recommendation. And there was one in there from the president of Eastern Washington University, who I had talked for 3 years. And it was a favorable letter saying, and commenting on my stuttering also. And he said, gee, you have talked for 3 years before as a stutterer, and this is a complimentary letter. He said, we'll give you a try. So that's how I got hired on.
Were these experiences, so, like, you faced challenges in the Army, you faced challenges being hired as a professor, you had somebody telling you you shouldn't become a speech pathologist because you stutter. Are these things that made you stronger and tougher?
Oh, I think so. I think so. Yes. I think many times that's probably true in other areas of our lives. Someone says, you're not going to be able to do this. You're never going to be able to walk again. You're never going to be able to, you know. And it probably makes us stronger in the long run, yes. We make every effort to prove people wrong and can sort of say years later, look, I've done it, you know. And that's very satisfying. Might sound conceited, but I think that's okay.
I totally agree with you. And I actually think that's a great place for us to take a quick break, and then we'll come on back for more Stutter Talk.
This is John Stossel. Anything that makes it harder for you to speak limits your life. So if stuttering affects you or your child or someone you know, you can call the Stuttering Foundation for help. The number is 800-992-9392. That's toll-free, 800-992-9392. Or you can visit their website, www.stutteringhelp.org. They can refer you to expert help in your state.
This is David Seidler. I'm a stutterer, and this is Stutter Talk.
Hi, this is Tricia Zabrowski from the University of Iowa, and you are listening to Stutter Talk.
I am a scientist, I seek to understand.
Welcome back to Stutter Talk. I am Peter Reitzes here with very special, distinguished guest, Dr. Dorvin H. Breitenfeld, Professor Emeritus at Eastern Washington University, the creator of the successful stuttering management program, and a huge influence on my life and on the lives of hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people. I just want to mention that the Stutter Talk resource of the month for March 2011 is Advice to Those Who Stutter, the second edition, which is a publication by the Stuttering Foundation. One of the reasons that this is the resource, or the suggested resource of the month, is that Dr. Breitenfeld has a wonderful chapter in that book that I encourage everyone to read. So if you go to stuttertalk.com, there'll be a link to the book. You can actually read the entire book online, and I encourage everyone to do so. So, Dorv, I really want to talk to you about your views on therapy and the successful stuttering management program. There's so many places to dig in. So, Dorv, in that Stuttering Foundation book, you had mentioned that there are three main goals of good therapy. To reduce fear, to 2, alter the stuttering pattern, and to 3, develop a maintenance program following the therapy. Now, some people might be listening and say, you know, Dorf didn't mention anything about fluency. Why isn't fluency one of your major goals of therapy?
It hasn't been. I think in my own case and in working with stutterers and attempting to use a fluency approach, fluency just doesn't seem to hold up. You soon get a stutterer who then continues to try to be fluent and goes right back to avoidance and being that covert stutterer. So in therapy, we never even mention the word fluency. That is not a goal at all. And this, very much on the first day, to the disappointment of some of our stutterers, we say, if you come here to get cured of your stuttering, to become fluent, this is the wrong place.
It's a very powerful environment. I mean, I'll just share with you, when I got to the University of Utah, where the Successful Stuttering Management Program did many courses, I was there in a room with maybe 12 people who stutter, 12 stutterers, about 12 graduate clinicians and several speech language pathologists and you. And before we knew it, we were all outside stuttering on purpose, going up to people and telling them that we stuttered. And it was sort of like this tidal wave. I mean, it was just like all of a sudden we're outside and you and Tom Gerster were going up to people and stuttering on purpose and saying, hi, my name is Dorv. I'm a person who stutters. I'm a stutterer. I'd like to talk to you about stuttering. And it really felt like you were throwing us all into the swimming pool. And then pretty soon, every single person there was doing the same thing. Where did that idea come from?
And I think, first of all, I soon realized that stutterers are very tough people, very durable, and you can toss them into situations immediately, and I think one should. I don't think you have to do this progressively at all, but typically, the second day of therapy, the stutterers go outside and talk with strangers, but I think what's extremely important, probably the most important thing in therapy, is that the clinician at all times does it first. Does it first for the stutterer. And if they're not a stutterer, and most clinicians are not, that they learn how to fake the stuttering as severe as the stutterer stutters. To show them, yes, I can take some of your pain. And then if they see that the non-stuttering clinician can do this and play the role of a stutterer, if he or she can do that, I am the stutterer, I can do that too.
Yeah.
And so I think you can take that big jump to begin to reduce word fears, situation fears, as well as getting that stuttering out into the open by putting the stutter into challenging situations immediately in therapy. I have done that with stutterers during the interview process. We go outside, say, I want to hear what your stuttering is like. Let me show you what we're going to do. Or I'm going to have you make a phone call. Let me show you what we're going to do. And I make it first by showing my stuttering. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a strong advocate of getting the stuttering out. Almost all stutterers have a lot of covert aspects to their stuttering. Probably up to 80-90% or more is what we don't see, and you can't change something if you don't see or hear. And so I've found our stutterers, many of them being quite almost disappointed that we're halfway through the workshop, and all we've been doing so far is talking to many people, making telephone calls, and letting my stuttering out, not avoiding it, dropping my secondaries and my starters and all other avoidances. And so they're now saying to themselves, oh my God, I've never stuttered outwardly so much in my life.
Yeah.
Or they say, I've never stuttered this much in my life. And we simply tell them, you haven't stuttered outwardly that much, but that stuttering has all been there. And the more you can get out now, and they'll probably never get all of it out. They've been hiding it for years. But most of it, sort of a bath of stuttering, I think Van Riper or some people have called it. Stutter needs a bath of stuttering.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can start to work on it if it's out in the open. You can't work on something that isn't there.
I believe when I was at the SSMP, it was approximately a three-week program, and literally the first, I don't know, 8 or 9 days was just stuttering openly. There were no speech tools or what you call handling techniques. It was just being open about your stutter, and there were people who, in the program, who came in who could pass as fluent. And by that seventh or eighth day, they were stuttering hundreds of times openly a day. And I'll never forget a very young, a young high school student, a really, really tough, tough young man was in the program that summer. And he counted one day on his tallying book something like, I don't even know, 200 or 300 stutters. And he just started crying. Joy, you know, not being upset, like, I'm so happy that I'm finally talking. What could you, something, there are many very special aspects of the SSMP. Can you explain to the listeners what tallying is and why tallying is used?
Again, I think before a stutterer can really learn to manage the stutter, he has to know exactly when it occurs. And stutterers say, oh, I know when I'm stuttering. Well, in most cases, if they know there are 3-4 words past it before, they say, oh, I stuttered way back there. And so if you're going to manage that stuttering, you have to manage it right when it occurs. And one way of assisting a stutterer is tallying. That is, every time he has a stuttering block, we have a little tally booklets, and we say you take that every place except in the shower, and every time you have a block, you look down, you tally it, and then you look back up and continue talking. And of course, that's very, very difficult to do. Again, the clinician must demonstrate it first, must demonstrate it in the mirror. I'm a strong believer in mirror work for the stutterer as well. So that helps the stutterer stop immediately after the block, immediately, not 2 or 3 words afterwards, and also it encourages him to go into it as well, so he does have opportunities to tally, and that's important that he goes into the block, brings it stuttering out into the open. And we have found that the stutterer can tally it well, identify every time he stutters using eye contact with the listener, stopping right afterwards, tallying the way typically people tally for straight marks and a slash mark over it. And some will even have a competition of how many tallies they can have in a day's time. But this therapeutically assists greatly on down the road as you teach the stutter management techniques.
Yeah, and I recall at the time you mentioning that it was kind of a form of advertising where you're taking out a small pad of paper, and when you stutter, you're right in front of the listener, you're making a note. Like, you're taking your time, you're going all the way through the stutter, and then you're making a note on a piece of paper, and you're letting the listener know that you're actively working on your speech. It's really interesting that most listeners seem to have a neutral or positive response to this. Like, they seem to appreciate that you're doing something to help yourself.
And you're absolutely right that this not only assists the stutterer in recognizing when he stutters, so later when you work on managing it, it's easier to do that, but it also is a tremendous form of advertising. The listener soon sees, oh, a person has a long stuttering block there and stops right afterwards and is making notation and looking right back at me, continuing to talk, showing, as you have said, that he is making effort to do something about it. And that improves the speaking situation considerably. We admire people who do something about their problems. See someone practicing some activity on one leg that he's lost in a rock or someplace like that, and we say, gee, look, now that person is even participating in mini marathons. Develop a certain pride of what this person has done. And so that's extremely important, I think, in tallying. Again, we don't tally during the last half of the therapy program, but I think it's necessary in some way, and that's one way of doing it, to recognize the stuttering when it occurs.
Another really interesting part of that first half of the SSMP are the stuttering surveys, where you have people go out with clipboards and t-shirts that say stuttering on them, and we just went up to people in malls, on the college campus, at restaurants, and said, my name is Peter, I'm a person who stutters, I'm working on my speech, can I ask you some questions about stuttering? Why did you put that as such a major part of the program?
I think, first of all, the stutterer is really quite surprised as he asks questions like, how do you feel when you talk to a stutterer? And those lay folks said, gee, I never thought about it. I guess I feel okay. I feel a bit impatient, but not a biggie with me. And he's really surprised that people will listen, but they listen. The reason they stop and listen, or one of the reasons, is that he's frankly advertised and talked, said, I am a stutterer, and would you be a bit of help? Would you mind? Take a minute of your time and ask you a few questions. Not asking for sympathy or even empathy, but to show he is working on the problem, and could that person or group of people take a moment just to help? And it's amazing how helpful people are. Just like people love to give directions. You ask almost anybody, where can I find such and such place? And they say, oh, yeah, I'll help you.
Yeah.
And people do enjoy being helpful. Of course, they're going to be walkaways, and we have something called a walkaway award.
Yeah.
By the way, it's possible to receive an award for failing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's what a walkaway award can do. When people walk away, they don't want to talk to you. They'd probably walk away if somebody else stopped them and wanted to know some other information.
Yeah, you also have such a wonderful, I mean, the whole stuttering awards thing is incredible. You have an award for the biggest block, and I'll never forget a day where a stutterer was having a really tough day, and you went over and you gave him an award for having the longest block. And he was so upset and so happy at the same time. It was wonderful. Dorf, I've got so many questions that I want to ask you. When I was at the program in Utah, there was one stutterer there who was really resistant to stuttering openly. This person just did not want to use voluntary stuttering. They didn't want to advertise. They didn't want to do stuttering surveys. And I remember them saying to you they didn't want to do these things, and now it was like the third day. And as I recall, you said to them, look, you're going to do it or you're going to fall behind. And that seemed to me like a really good example of...
Kind of cruel, wasn't it?
Well, tough love. I don't know. I mean, I never thought of it as cruel, to be honest with you, but I thought of it as tough. Do you see yourself as sort of a tough love therapist? And do you think that might be missing in today's therapy a little bit?
I think it probably is missing, and yes, I guess I probably do see myself as at times a tough therapist, call it the tough love, or someone said, oh, you have to be cruel to be kind,
mm-hmm.
And maybe that's true. The stutterer can soon find all kinds of reasons why he shouldn't do this, and he will frequently want to ask more questions about it. Sometimes you simply say, oh, trust us, let's get on with therapy. And no one wants to be behind everybody else. I found that's a comment I frequently made to a stutterer. You are a day and a half behind everybody else, or you're a day behind, 2 days behind. You're a bright guy, you're a bright lady. Can you catch up by tomorrow? And nobody wants to be behind your peers.
Well, you, if you don't mind me sharing this, you said that to me at one point. We were working on the handling techniques, and you said, like, look, Peter, you're going to be a speech therapist. You need to know this stuff better. You're a little behind the rest of us. And I was hurt for a second, and then I got really inspired because I did not want to be behind, you know? I don't even think you would recall that. But you're basically saying to me, you need to model these handling techniques a little bit better. So I wasn't used to tough love. I didn't have a lot of people in my life who did tough love. And so, you know, it was a new experience for me. I hope you don't mind me bringing that up on air.
No, not at all. And I think, again, we don't need to handle stutterers with kid gloves. They are tough people, and they've gotten this far in life with all their stuttering. They can really do things they thought they couldn't do at all, and the sooner the better. And, again, we as clinicians should always do it first, always demonstrate first. Say, okay, now it's your turn, now you do it. And it's important we go out with them. We just don't send the stutterer out to talk to five people on the street and ask them where the local bank is and advertise their stuttering. They're not going to do that. You have to go with them. And that's highly important that you're there also.
Yeah, and you would say at the SSMP, you would say to us clinicians, if you give an assignment, you need to do it because it's only reasonable if you do it. And if you won't do it, then it's not a reasonable assignment. And I always really liked that piece of advice.
Yes, I think we need to inform the stutterer, any assignments I have here for you to do tonight or this week or whatever, if there's any of them you feel you can't do, turn them back to me, and I will do them with you. And then, of course, it's your turn to do it.
Yeah.
And they need to realize that you will do anything you ask them to do. And I think that's only fair.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That has been really influential on me. And very recently, I was at a meeting where a speech therapist came up to me and was saying that she was having her stutterers do these breathing techniques. And I said to her, well, would you do them? And she goes, no, they're very hard. I won't do them. And I said to her, well, if you're not going to do them, what makes you think your stutterer should do them? She says, well, I'm not a stutterer. I'm like, I know. But if you're not willing to go out and use these for an hour, then why should your clients? So I still keep those thoughts on my mind a lot. Let's remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk 206-666-5340, stuttertalk@stuttertalk.com. Dorf, before we get into the handling techniques to the speech tools, you are a big advocate of lifestyle changes to coincide with therapy. So you bring up things like personal or organization, outward appearance, in interpersonal and social relationships, personal health. Why are these things important to the stutterer?
Well, we're just not only a stutterer, we're a whole person who also stutters. And that if we make lifestyle changes, it's sort of like I remember the first time when somebody pinned the two measly gold bars on my shoulder and called me lieutenant. I functioned differently, I looked at them differently, I got my hair cut short, and so forth. And so suddenly I changed my lifestyle as well and played the role. Many stutterers, I think, because of their stuttering, may have avoided making chit-chat and conversation because they just couldn't, and they become tremendously good listeners, although I can still become a good listener if I'm not careful and not participate. So we need to discuss these things. And here's some things you can do to not just become a good listener, but also participate. It's important that the stutterer stay in good health, eat a healthy diet, physical exercise, and so forth, as we find for almost all of us stutterers, and I do too. When my health isn't good, I have a severe cold or something like that, my stuttering isn't good. And so by keeping ourselves healthy, physically eating healthy diet, so forth, we can manage our stuttering better. I have much more difficulties managing my stuttering when I am ill.
Yes.
And the stutterer, I think, doesn't have the luxury of being disorganized. Non-stutterers probably can. They can come into the classroom and drop all their notebooks and everything else and pick it up and still answer a question from the teacher. Well, we stutterers better be prepared ahead of time, better be structured, because it takes a heck of a lot of energy and concentration to continue to manage our stuttering. And if you have to try to manage organization at the same time, managing stuttering is going to be much more difficult. So I really advocate almost being erotic about it, I guess, being structured and being organized. And non-stutterers tell me that's advantageous for them too. And then you have time to play, to get your work done, so forth. And there's nothing wrong with playing. Sometimes stutterers don't play or don't enjoy themselves anymore, but by being organized, structured, and so forth, they can complete their life's daily tasks and also have time to play too.
Now, at the SSMP, it felt like a very regimented program, and it was a lot of hard work. I think that was the first place I ever heard the saying, stuttering is hard work. We worked all day, then we had dinner, and then we went out and had just homework assignment after homework assignment. Where did that come from, your years of military service, this very regimented approach to dealing with stuttering?
I suppose that probably added to it, or sort of an accumulation of lifetime experiences, I suppose. I don't think it all came just from military experience where, yes, you're very regimented. But I've simply found in my own life that I had to organize things, even organizing my closet so I didn't have to search each morning for a particular tie or a pair of shoes or a shirt. I knew where it would be. I think both from other experiences, but particular experiences with my own life, being able to manage the stuttering better if I'm prepared. If I'm prepared ahead of time, and you are prepared if you are structured and organized.
The personal organization, the health, the outward appearance. For me, it was also about when you change different aspects of your life, such as your health and your appearance, that it also perhaps changes how you deal with stuttering. Like, I found that it was easier to change several things at once. When I first started to face my stuttering, I all of a sudden began working out, because it was suggested to me that if I were healthier and started to lift weights and to run, it might help me make other changes. And I think that might be part of what you're talking about, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think absolutely it is, that if we make changes in other aspects of our lives, it's easier to make changes in our speech, with our stuttering. If we just take one area only and neglecting the others, I don't think we do it nearly as well.
Hmm. Agreed. You know, on Stutter Talk, we've talked a lot over the years about the handling techniques, the speech tools that are part of stuttering modification. So instead of asking you about the different tools that you recommend at the SSMP, maybe I'll ask you instead, you know, why do you bring in the tools during the second half of the intensive program?
I know many therapy programs and clinicians will start probably the first or second day in therapy to provide the stutterer with some tools and management techniques for their stuttering. My experience has been that's much too soon because you don't have the stuttering out in the open, and the techniques are not going to work if stuttering is so hot. By hot, I mean the fears are so great. The heart rate has doubled. The avoidances are so great. So I think those have to be reduced. You're never going to eliminate them entirely. But if the fears of talking, the avoidances, speaking situations, and the speech talking itself are reduced, then you can learn to manage the stuttering. And so, therefore, I've postponed giving any management techniques at all. I think the only one we gave in the first half of the workshop is use of eye contact. And we know that's extremely important whether you're stutter or not. And beyond that, we do no management techniques until the stutter has had opportunities to reduce the fears by actually doing the feared situations, making telephone calls, getting the stuttering out of the open, and then without the stuttering being such a great anxiety to him, to her, it's easier to manage the stuttering.
Now, I really liked your specific way of teaching eye contact, because everybody always talks about eye contact, but you were the first person I ever heard say, you said something along the lines of, it's not about having constant eye contact, it's about making sure that when you stutter, you're looking at somebody. That's when you need the eye contact. So you're stuttering with confidence and not shame. And I just wanted to share with you that really helped me get why eye contact was so important.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'd agree entirely. That's probably the most important time to maintain eye contact. Many stutterers come to us that's when they don't maintain eye contact. But when you don't, during stuttering moments, you are telling your listener, once again, I'm ashamed of my stuttering. Look, I'm looking away. I'm not maintaining eye contact. But we can maintain eye contact and sometimes even have a smile and say, oh, there's a good one. Let me try that again.
Yeah.
Make some comment on it. And I'm a strong believer in the use of humor also. And I think the best humor is always the humor on ourselves. If you're bald-headed, then you talk about your bald head. And
yes.
If you're a stutterer, you're the first one. You have a license to tell stuttering jokes. Non-stutterers, I don't think, have.
Yeah.
We have. And we're the ones who should tell them and feel free to laugh. But even though stutterers will say originally, it's not funny to me at all. But we say, well, try it. Soon you'll find you get a healthier response back from the listener, and then you soon say, oh, I better do this again because I'm getting healthy responses back from my listener because I can make some light of my stuttering.
One of the criticisms I've heard of the SSMP is that some people go through the program and they come out of the program and they're stuttering the same amount. How do you respond to somebody who's concerned about that?
Mm-hmm. Hopefully, they are stuttering the same amount in various situations, but they are doing something about it. In other words, they are managing it. They're stuttering using eye contact now. They are now, even though some will show more stuttering because more outward stuttering, and obviously so, because they're no longer avoiding all the speaking situations, avoiding talking. Circumlocution, talking around feared words, using starter devices, postponement devices, on and on. No longer use these, well, certainly you would have more stuttering, more outward stuttering. Actually, you're not a more severe stutterer, you're just showing more outward stuttering. And so you're supposed to do that. But what's important here is that you're able now to communicate successfully, even with maybe more stuttering, but hopefully in managing it at least most of the time. We're not going to manage it all of the time. We get caught off guard and we don't have all of our management tools handy, and we know it varies so much from situation to situation. And so don't be too hard on yourself. Many stutterers are too hard on themselves. They're expecting perfection. Maybe stutterers are more perfectionists than non-stutterers are. You're going to have to accept for the rest of your life, and I don't know how to cure a stutter. Not many stutterers I know of have been, quote, cured. You'll never to stutter again. You're going to have to learn to live with it successfully, and that's why the word successful is in the title of the program, successful management of it.
I think it's hard for some people to understand that for many of us, the act of stuttering is success, is not failure, is the actual success. I really want to know who your mentors were in the field, some of your memories of the field. Did you know people like Wendell Johnson, Dean Williams, Charles Van Riper, Joseph Sheehan, and were some of them your colleagues or your mentors?
Yes, I knew them. I more so knew of them or would meet them at conferences and so forth. I did not attend universities where they were teaching at and so forth. And so they're probably not specifically my mentors. Some of my mentors were those professionals who worked the stuttering workshops as I went through them at the University of Minnesota, and one lady, Miffany Chapman, was not a stutterer, but a public school speech pathologist who knew just a great deal about stuttering, and so during the summertime she would be a clinician in the stuttering workshop. And it happened that she was a clinician in the stuttering workshop that I was in, and then 8 years later I was her student teacher in the public schools. So things do get tied together sometimes. And so people like that, I think there are a number that were my mentors, certainly seeing other people who were stutterers managing their lives as stutterers was advantageous to me, gave me a drive that if they can do it, perhaps I can too.
Last question. How many years have you been a speech pathologist? For 40 years or so?
57, I guess that's, 4 years, although some of this is retirement now.
Sure. So a lifetime of stuttering, about 50 years or so of being a speech language pathologist. What's one thing you would like to see happen in our field or in the treatment of stuttering, or what's one place you would like our field to go?
Mm-hmm. I guess if there's a disappointment I've had with our profession is that student clinicians are coming through undergraduate and graduate programs, and they obtain the certificate of clinical competence, implying they are competent clinically, without even having seen or worked with one stutterer. And I think that's unfortunate. And so most clinicians, and it's not their fault at all, if they don't feel competent and qualified to work with stutterers, it's really the student training program's fault. And I devoted almost all my life to student training programs. Here's where the problem exists, and I would like to see that our graduates came out with actual clinical experience with stutterers, so when they see the first stutterer, they don't say, oh my God, what do I do? I guess I better read up on stuttering and see what they said in that one course I had.
Yes, and I think that's a wonderful point, and And I will thank you for training so many clinicians and for being so dedicated to that. And I don't know what percentage of speech pathologists come out of graduate school without a course in stuttering. I know that just on Friday, there was a speech pathologist who came to me for advice on stuttering, and she told me that in graduate school, her stuttering course was an elective. She didn't have to take it, and she didn't. But I could talk to you all day, Dorm, but I will let you go. I cannot thank you enough for all that you've done for stuttering, that you'll continue to do for stuttering, and for coming on Stutter Talk.
Well, thank you very much, Desmond, and honored to be on Stutter Talk, and again to chat with a former student and a stutterer and as well, and someone who is now making many contributions to the stuttering community. And you need to be proud of these, and I want to compliment you on what you've done for the stuttering community, and obviously we're continuing to do. We like to see our young professionals take over these roles.
Thank you so very much. It means so much to me, and I'll just say to you that when we started Stutter Talk, it was because there was no stuttering on the airwaves, and it was like it was because of people like Dorvin Breitenfeld and because of the SSMP. So I think took the spirit of what you've started and what you've done, and just sort of moved it. Thank you, and moved it sort of onto the airwaves. So again, thank you, Dorv. You've been listening to Stutter Talk. Peter Reitz is here with Dr. Dorvin H. Breitenfeld. Dorv, I hope to have you back on the air soon.